And we're real fortunate tonight to be joined in studio by Jerry Vandiver. And Jerry is a Nashville singer and songwriter. He's had songs that have sold over 13 million records, which is just amazing. He's had two songs that are in the Country Music Hall of Fame. And as an aside, he's also a good friend of one of Cook County's favorite Nashville writers, and that, of course, is John
Vesner.
Vesner. Where did that go?
I wasn't going to say
one of our best. One of our
somebody
best
had to jump in.
One
you
of
know
our best friends.
What is wrong when you're our age? I guess the brain goes. I don't know where it goes. But
senior cells.
Yeah, Jerry, we want to welcome you. Anyway, I'll forget your name before interview is over. Welcome
I won't
to the
remember
Roadhouse.
Yours either, Charlie.
But you've been up here now for a week and
yes.
Been lucky to be out in the Boundary Waters in a canoe.
Yeah.
What a nice start to
it's,
for your stay.
Well, I've come here quite often, actually, and have been drawn to the area for about 15 years now with that in mind, and have come to love the area and Grand Marais as well. And I just came out this morning with a drenched soul and clothing as well.
Yeah, that's the one part about canoeing, that rain is not always your friend.
But it's part of the process.
It
it's
is.
Part of the journey. Yeah. But
so,
it does, it cleanses the soul. And I'm you know, it's funny. I'm sitting out on the on a ledge and just looking over the lake, and a loon's calling, and I'm thinking, you know, right now I really don't care if Reba McEntire's cutting next week or not. It's
okay.
you just kind of stay in the present moment, and that's why I come up. Yeah,
yeah.
It's great.
Do you find that when you're relaxing like that, of course you're forgetting the business aspect of it, but is the creative part of it still there?
Oh, yes. In fact, I've actually written a couple of songs in the Boundary Waters, and I don't bring in the technology to record the song, so I have to keep singing them myself for a week so I don't forget it by the time I come out, so I can get my tape recorder and put it on. But I've written several songs. Yeah. Regular songs. I've written a song about portaging called Rocks and Roots.
Wow.
In fact, yeah. Yeah. Because
now, do your canoe partners appreciate the fact that you're singing the same song?
No. In fact,
all the way?
In fact, my canoe partner just now was, before we came in, was complaining that he was really tired of hearing this song. So
it's something that we've talked about before. To folks, you know, you create this song in your head, but how do you keep it there?
Yeah,
and you obviously just
constantly
keep it there by
singing. Mm-hmm.
But
normally, though, I would have a tape recorder, you know, by the side of the bed or with me, or my computer. Nowadays, with the technology, you've got GarageBand or whatever, you can just put it up real quickly. Or you know, if I have a tape recorder, you know, in the car, and I come up with something, I might, you know, reach down and go for it there. And if I, you know, if I hit a telephone pole on the way, then I know I've got a smash hit. Sorry.
See, when you're remembering or thinking of this song that you created out there, are you thinking about the melody, or are you thinking about the words, or how did, I mean, do you create them both?
They really come at the same time.
Oh, they do?
Yes.
That's
yes.
Amazing.
Yeah. I mean, the idea is really the tantamount part of the song. Uh-huh. That's the present. I'm thinking about this subject that has crossed my mind while I'm paddling or at the campfire, or in a writer's room somewhere, either. It doesn't matter where you are at that point when you're writing a song. But generally speaking, there's a lyric and a melody that kind of starts to weave itself together. And as you start coming up with a melody, then hopefully a lyric falls into place with that meter of the melody, and vice versa. You come up with a lyric, then you want a melody to fall into that. And so they do kind of come at the same time. I mean, one of them doesn't really come first before the other.
Okay.
This is the answer to that question.
Yeah. And you moved to Nashville in 1984. You were from Kansas City, I believe.
Yes, Kansas City.
Was that something you felt was necessary to become a songwriter?
Oh,
to be there?
Absolutely. The business is there. The decision making is there. And in fact, there's one of the people at ASCAP, which is a performance rights society there, and a networking business. They have a saying called "You need to be present to win," and because you run into a producer of a record company or whatever at the post office, and or this and that, or you run into Emmy Lou Harris, and you or you
do you really?
I knew that was coming.
Bob wants to be a songwriter.
Do
now.
You
Bob,
really?
Bob, come on down. But you know, or you run into, you know, one of my best friends that I used to hire as a guitar player, and we became friends. He is now a producer for Rodney Atkins, who is a major label artist there, and he always invites me to give him songs for the project that's coming up. And those kinds of things cannot happen when I'm 600 miles away in Kansas City, Missouri. It's just part of being there. Plus, being there and really, really seeing the quality of writing and the quality of musicianship makes you raise your level, too, to come to that, because you have to be on top of everything. I mean, you can network all you want, but if you don't have a good song, it still won't get recorded. You still, and you really do. If you work hard enough, I think you can get the craft exposed to you and start really embracing that, because it is an important part of it, is the craft of writing, which is, to me, is just a matter of taking that music and lyrics and making them accessible so that your public can understand what you're trying to talk about in your songs.
So now here you are. You've landed in Nashville. You find an apartment somewhere.
Yep.
What do you do? You know you want to be a writer.
Yeah.
But how do you go about it now? I mean, how do you meet folks? How do you get them to take you seriously?
Good question. Well, first of all, you get a job.
Okay. Yeah. Number one.
You know, yeah, I mean, there's
money.
Got to pay the rent for that apartment just moved into. You know, there's several things about what do you call a songwriter without a wife? Homeless. You know, how do you, I'll give one more and then I'll answer your question.
Okay.
How do you get a songwriter in Nashville off your front porch? Pay him for the pizza. So with that in mind, The great thing about Nashville is that it has it's a very welcome and warm community, very creative community. And there's in Nashville, there is every night of the week there is a writer's night somewhere, where a writer can go and work hard at performing their songs and getting their songs exposed. And when I go out and perform, say at the Bluebird Cafe on a writer's night on Sunday, there may be someone in that audience that likes what I hear and says, I like what you're doing lyrically. I'm a melody writer. You interested in getting together? And if she's cute, then you say yes. You know? But if he's a good writer too, you say yes. And it kind of grows very slowly. It doesn't happen overnight. In fact, they say that it takes about 4 to 6 years once you've really committed yourself 24/7 to the craft and the business of songwriting, and you're in Nashville working hard. It takes about 4 to 6 years to get your first song recorded. And it's because it takes time to do all that networking and go to those writers' nights. There's also, to answer your question, there's also a lot of workshops available through, I'm wearing a hat that says Nashville Songwriters Association. They have a workshop every Thursday night. Where you play for publishers, or you get your songs critiqued, or they have a teacher teaching, and they really work hard at letting you work hard at, you know, making your craft better. And in addition to that, there's number one parties that you crash, you know, and you just never know who you run into at all those situations. And there, everybody has what they call them guitar pulls down there. And it's, I call them picking parties, where people just get together on Fridays and Saturday nights and barbecue and, you know, get out the guitar and play their latest song. And then another one pulls the guitar out and let me play you mine. And, you know, and that's it happens. And all those things, when you immerse yourself in that, it's very exciting. It's very fun. It's very creative. And if you're lucky, you might get a song cut.
Now, you're saying you had to have patience 5-6 years. In retrospect, you've been very successful over the years.
I've been fortunate, yes. Yeah.
But when you moved there, you're probably a little more impatient than that.
I was.
Yeah.
I was. In fact, patience is not my virtue, nor is it any successful songwriter's virtue. It's something you really have to toe the line on. It's a great question. In addition to all those things I mentioned and going to the writers' nights and stuff, I came with my armload of songs like every other songwriter does in Nashville, and I started calling publishers and pitching songs right away. I shudder to think about what those publishers thought about those songs. In retrospect, back in 1984, 25 years ago, well, 26 years ago now, they were horrible. I mean, they really were. But for whatever reason, you know, I persevered. And publishers and people in the business they want to like you, and they'll tell you this song has a lot of bad stuff in it, but here's some good stuff, and I want to encourage you to keep going. And I got a lot of encouragement, and that's what kept me going, and that kind of controlled my patience a little bit.
Yeah. And your songs are country songs.
More or less.
More or less. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's where your big hits
have
been.
Yes, and that's the business there. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But they're not all necessarily country songs that come out of Nashville.
Not at all. In fact, Nashville is kind of becoming a major music center of more than just country. There's a lot of rock and roll that's coming out of there. There's alternative. In fact, the Americana Music Association, which is kind of a jumble of folk and acoustic and singer-songwriter music, is kind of centralized in Nashville as well. It's a great community for all kinds of
all
music.
Kinds of music, absolutely.
Yeah, it really is.
You know, it might be a good time to listen to some
we can do that.
Songs that you've written.
I can do that.
You brought your guitar.
I did bring my guitar.
By the way, Buck,
yes.
We had a listener call in. We don't want to do it right now, that has a question.
Yeah.
Ask me to ask Jerry a question. So we'll save that for after
right.
that.
Okay, good. Is it one that I can answer?
We'll review it.
Okay, good.
I think it is.
Okay.
It might be a yes or no. Who knows?
That'd be easy. All right. So we want to do a song?
Yeah. Now we'll listen to Jerry.
Grab my guitar here. Let's see.
Jerry, move that blue mic down a little closer to your...
This one here, about kind of closer to the guitar.
To the accent.
There we go. That'll look great.
Good.
And you know what? I'm going to get these off because... Whoops, wait a second. That's too complicated.
You are aware, Jerry, that this is radio, aren't you?
Yeah.
It looks kind of like me trying to manipulate
the listeners, I was trying to take my glasses off. And
seen Buck try to walk out the door with his headphones on.
No, that's not always easy.
You know, I always... do you want to hear one of my hits, or do you want to hear something that will probably never be recorded?
You know, we want to hear something you'd like to play.
Okay, I'll sure. do... This is I've always been fascinated with the concept that in human relationships that someone has to be vulnerable enough to be the first one to say those three words, I love you, and that's hard. That's yeah.
Thought it was I'm out of here.
Bob doesn't ever do that kind of thing. That's why he's never going to meet Emily Harris. Anyway, so I've written several on that concept, but this one I put on my CD, and I will be doing tomorrow night as well, unless I do it badly and people scares people away. But it's called Someone Has to Be the First. I don't know if what I'm about to say is what you want to hear. I don't know if it's your deepest hope or your greatest fear. I don't know if I'm shutting myself out or opening heaven's door. All I know is I can't keep it here inside another second more. Someone has to be the first to say I love you. Someone has to take their heart and turn the key. Someone has to be the first to say I love you. And it looks like tonight that someone is me. You don't have to say a single word about how you feel. Your eyes don't have to meet with mine, afraid of what they'll reveal. You don't have to say I love you too. I don't mean to make this hard. It's just enough for me to know that you know what's in my heart. Someone has to be the first to say I love you. Someone has to take their heart and turn the key. Someone has to be the first to say I love you. And And it looks like tonight that someone is me. Yes, it looks like tonight that someone is me.
Jerry Vandiver, everybody. That's
beautiful.
Just a beautiful song.
Yeah,
you know, that
very nice.
Touches on, like a lot of great songs, that really touches on emotions, and my emotion is fear.
You've proven that over and over and over again.
Well, I'm sure glad to bring that out. In
fact. Go
you know,
ahead,
along
Bob.
With that, though, Wendell Smith.
Oh, is he on? He sent in a question? Okay, I know Wendell, so this is probably plugged in. Okay.
Wants to have asked Jerry about his wedding.
Oh, okay. I'm glad. Thank you, Wendell, for asking that. My wife and I, my wife number two, she's the best wife I've ever had.
That's good. You better say that again.
I'm her favorite husband, she says. We got married in the Boundary Waters on the Ely side. We got married at Entry Point 23 at Mudrow Lake, and we had our reception at the Chainsaw Sisters Saloon.
Oh yeah,
yeah,
that's wild.
We did. It was great. And we put a Just Married sign on our canoe and paddled off into the wilderness. Had a great. It was a great time. Great wedding. About 25 people showed up. Hmm. Wendell being one of them, and it was a lot. In fact, I think Wendell's dog in the middle of the ceremony came out of the creek and shook and sprayed. He did.
Rather than throwing rice.
Yeah, right. We didn't get any rice thrown on us there. Yeah, it was just water from the creek there at Mudrow Lake. But yeah, that's right. We got married here in the Boundary Waters. Hmm. We love it that much.
Cool.
Yeah.
How long ago was that?
That was 5 years ago, this September 12th.
Well, it worked, obviously.
It did.
Yeah.
It took so far, and I think it's going to take for quite a long time.
Well, let's hope so. Good for you, Jerry. Yeah, I was where I was going with that business about emotion in the song. What facets of songwriting? What makes a good song in your mind? What are you happy with when you're done? What things have to be there?
Wow, what I'm happy with when I'm done is I'm not sure that I'm done until I play it and I get a response. Mm. And if that response is what I hope to be, in other words, people either they're laughing or there maybe is a little tear in the side of their eye or they're smiling or they really applaud with great, you know, excitement, or they tell me that this song really touched me. That's what you hope to accomplish. And then, of course, after that, you hope that some big star will record the song, and you'll actually reap the financial benefits as well. But that's not, you know, you don't write. It's one of the things about Nashville songwriting in particular. But they say you can't do it for the money, or you lose the heart, and that's very true. And you hope, of course, like I said, that it will get recorded, so you can make a living at it. But you hope to reach someone, and you hope when I to answer your question, I try to make my song what I call accessible. In other words, when I play that song for you, you understand what it is I'm trying to convey. You know, obviously when I'm playing that song, I'm not telling you, Buck, that I'm going to be the first one to say I love you.
Let's hope not.
But you understand the circumstances of the situation and appreciate it.
Yeah.
And that's what you hope to accomplish, yeah.
But I think it's also interesting. Yeah, I know you were just kidding.
Who
weren't.
Knows?
But different people can get something different out of the same song, can't
they? That's very true. Yeah. You get very many different stories out of it and different. In fact, I have a song I've had a couple of ministers come up to me and they use it in marital counseling.
Really?
And I never thought that that would ever occur. Yeah, never thought that would happen. Hmm. It wasn't my intent for that to happen. It was just a story that a co-writer and I had discussed and I said, wow, that's a great idea for a song. Let's write that. And there it is. Some ministers have emailed me and said, I want you to know that I'm using this in counseling, and it's been very helpful. It's kind of interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah.
You know, we always I always talk about John Vesner's songs as being so well crafted.
Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm. And when I listen to the song that you've played for us so far, you know, on one level you might say, well, keep it simple. But there's a lot underneath that to make it a well-crafted song.
Yeah, it's not simple to write.
No.
But it needs to sound like it's simple when the listener hears it. In fact, we have you've heard the old saying, K-I-S-S?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We say it's keep it simple songwriter.
Oh,
and
you left the stupid out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
When Buck and I say it,
yeah,
the stupid stays.
Yeah.
So we have three S's there. Keep it simple, stupid songwriter. And So, but it is. It needs to come across. In fact, I've been surprised sometimes, and as a listener of my fellow songwriters too, when I hear great songs that I'm amazed at, it almost sounds like it was written in 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. But I know that in some cases it takes months to really of agonizing over every word and every note and letting it sit and stew for a little bit and then coming back and I think I can make this a little better here and it comes back out and but as long as it sounds like it was simply written to simply communicate, that's what a good 3 minute song will do, I hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that kind of an unwritten rule, is keep that song at a certain length? Or well, maybe it's written. I don't know.
No, it's not a written rule. Okay. I think in the actual business. I mean, I mentioned that you want to communicate with your audience, communicate with your listeners. At the same time, you would like to have a song recorded to make a living from it. And if it's going to be recorded to make a living on it, radio, not public radio, of course, but radio, they want they need a format of it about 2 minutes and 30 seconds to 3 minutes and 30 seconds. So I you know, at first I used to kind of get my feathers ruffled by that, to be dictated by that. But I sat back and I realized that it was actually kind of an interesting challenge to be able to create a song that still touches someone's heart and can do that within that short period of time. And I think one of the reasons why songs are successful on the radio or whatever, that people like them, is because it does that in a short period of time. You write a little, you know, 3.5 minute vignette, a little novelette of sorts, if you would, and if you can, it's hard to do, and if it accomplishes that, then in 3 minutes and 5 seconds or whatever, then I'm all for it.
So Alice's Restaurant would be kind of an anomaly then.
That would definitely be But you know, it is interesting. Alice's Restaurant was never a hit on hit radio.
No.
It was an FM underground kind of thing. You know, as an Agata DeVita. I mean, I know.
Yeah.
I'm looking at you guys. I know you played an Agata DeVita.
I did. I just don't remember
still play it. Yeah. And you better not. Well, Jerry, maybe you've got another tune you'd like to play. Do you mind?
I would be happy to. Let's do. Hold on a minute. I'm getting my.
We got the glasses off, so
we
got that
much.
Yeah, we
got the glasses off, but we still have the cords in the way.
We got other parts.
Parts is parts.
That's right.
Well, you know, let's see. Let's do a fun one
that
isn't quite as emotional.
Mm-hmm. I won't feel any fear this time.
Won't be quite as afraid.
This song has taken a journey like nobody's business, and you being in public radio, I think we'll even appreciate it even more. And without revealing all of it behind it, but this song. I wrote with a friend of mine, and he had this idea, and I begged him to let me write this song with him because he said, I have the stupid idea for a song. So that S came back in, the K-I-S-S. And I said, what is it? And he told me he wanted to write a song about a car mechanic in Athens, Georgia. Okay? You with me there?
Yeah.
All right. Now, my second time through college, I won't talk about the first, second time through college, I actually worked in a Volkswagen repair shop, so I knew a little bit about ratchets and rack and pinions and tune-ups and stuff like that. So, and he did, and then we brought in a third guy too, and the three of us wrote this song, and immediately it was recorded by a guy on Asylum Records named Curtis Day. Now you nod, but I know you've never heard of Curtis Day.
I think I have.
No, you haven't. You couldn't have. You only sold 6 copies. Okay. We joke about gold and platinum. This is a record that went plywood. Okay?
Trash can.
But he recorded it, and then I put it on my CD as well. But being on public radio, and being the subject of this particular song, being a car mechanic, it was featured on the break of Click and Clack.
The Hey,
yeah,
that's big.
That's big.
See, I, at that big. Point, I figured my career has peaked.
That's
you
right.
Know?
You were at the pinnacle of your career.
I was thrilled. I really was. And then my co-writer on the song got a record deal, and his name is Phil Vassar, and he put it on his American Child CD, and it made a video of it. And this is it. And I'm not going to tell you the title of it, but it's important. I got to set it up. Unfortunately, it's about a car mechanic from Athens, Georgia. So you got that part right.
Yep.
Okay, so if you ever are driving down in that area of the South and your car gets broken down, this is the guy you want to see. Okay?
Got it.
Well, if you're headed south on Georgia 129, straight into Athens past the Clark County line, there's an old Texaco right across from the Athens Woolworth. Now Billy Joe Taylor's underneath that lift. There ain't a car on the planet that he can't fix. He swears on his chrome-plated ratchet that's his heaven on earth. He can make a rusty muffler purr like a kitten or an old Nash Rambler top out at 150. George has never seen a man more at peace than when Billy's got his hands in Athens, Greece. Pretty stupid, isn't it? Gets better. Here you go. Now 6 days a week, he's a man on a mission. He's the redneck Picasso of the manual transmission. The only boy in town who can make Charlie Vincent's van go. Sorry. When the sun goes down and the day is ended, well, Billy's still rocking with a rack and pinion. Long as that boy's at work, he's right at home. A rusty muffler purr like a kitten or an old Nash Rambler top out at 150. George has never seen a man more at peace than when Billy's got his hands in Athens, Greece. Now he's a rotating lug nut and spark plugging good old boy with his name on his shirt. And Thelma Lou Taylor likes to hang out at the station cause she loves to watch him work. Cause he can make a rusty muffler purr like a kitten or an old Nash Rambler top out at 150. George has never seen a man more at peace than when Billy's got his hands in Athens, Greece.
That was fun. Jerry Vandiver, everybody out there. And I should mention that you're going to be playing at the Art Colony,
yes.
Grand Marais Art Colony. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock.
O'clock. Oh, I didn't know that. I thought it was 8, but it's 7 o'clock. I'm glad you told me.
We brought it up. Double check me. And I believe that people will pay at the door. There's no...
Actually,
there are some advanced sales.
There are. Okay.
Yeah, the $9 advance and $10 at the door.
Okay.
So
we got that clear. In fact, Joan could probably fill us in on that.
But Joan's already bought, I think, 30 or 40 tickets.
Good.
Yeah. Right.
Joan, of course, the Joan Farnham here, videotaping our session here tonight.
So. Yeah.
That's great.
Videotaping the back of your head.
And well, that's not so great. It's better than the front.
Yeah, I was going to say, that is your best side.
There's an advantage to that, standing behind me. You do some teaching, too, don't you, Jerry? That songwriting teaching.
Yes. Wife and I wrote a book about songwriting called Your First Cut, A Step-by-Step Guide to Getting There. And we go do workshops about everything from the craft of songwriting to what it really takes and kind of the step-by-step process of getting yourself in the business loop and making it happen for you. And we do that. Also, I used to be a teacher. In fact, I used to be a seventh grade science teacher. That's how I lost all my hair.
The kids,
and, yeah. And I'm also involved. We have a really neat program at the Country Music Hall of Fame in Nashville called Words and Music, in which kids come and they have from K through 12, all grade levels, and they have a unit about lyric writing. And kids will write lyrics, and then volunteer songwriters, one of which is myself, get together and pick out about 6 of those lyrics. And the kids come to the Hall of Fame, and we put melodies to them. And it's pretty neat. I recently wrote a song, put a melody to a lyric about a little girl who, I think she was 9 years old, and she had a cat named Peeve, and her title of her song was My Pet Peeve.
Oh, no.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
They're creative kids, you know. Yeah. So I like to be involved in that portion of it, too,
yeah.
as well.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great. I believe you did a teaching seminar appear locally with friend John Vesner.
With John Vesner and I 2 years ago, or maybe it was 3 now, I can't remember. It was before the Hamlet fire, because we were actually going to do it that year as well, and then the fire messed some things up. But yeah, John and I did a songwriting workshop up at Camp Minogen, mm-hmm. We called it Writers in the Woods. It was a lot of fun, and it was a great time. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one of these years, he's going to convince you to come up here for Unplugged.
Oh, he's convinced me to come up. He just has to get it in his head.
Get his head. Okay.
Oh, yeah, together. Jerry. I need to bring Jerry up. He keeps threatening to, but
we'll work on that.
Unfortunately, I won't be here then. I'm actually going to be in Saudi Arabia and with a friend of mine, and we're in a band, and we're playing for the troops over there.
Oh, well, great. Okay.
For you. Yeah, so that's great.
While John's having fun with you guys here, I'll be off in the Mideast. So.
I think we got time for one more tune, don't we, Bob?
Sure.
We got about 5 minutes, sure.
5 minutes? Well,
if you got
3 minute song, then.
3 minutes. Okay. There you go.
There we go. Okay.
Jerry Vandiver, everybody.
Let's see. What I want to do. I'll do this one. This is, I mentioned earlier about the one that the ministers were using in the counseling session. This is it here. This is called The Heel of the Bread. You like The Heel of the Bread?
It's the best part.
Okay, good. You're the guy this song was probably written about, then.
Well, let's hope not.
On Thursday nights, Betty made a roast. Lester would buy a warm loaf from the bakery after work at 5. Betty set the china plates. Lester said the nightly grace and carved the meat and bread with pride. And then he'd pass the heel along to her because she loved him. She choked it down without a word. Well, ain't it funny how we let our feelings go unsaid, and the time we lose when intentions are misread. And ain't it sad how we misjudge so many signs of love, like Lester and Betty and the heel of the bread. Well, 20 years of Thursday nights, Betty somehow wore a smile and kept her protest quietly concealed. But one night after a long, hard day, she threw that hated heel away, and with angry words her resentment was revealed. Well, Lester shook his head and said, if I had known, I gave it to you because it's the part I love the most. You're all supposed to go, oh, there you go. Ain't it funny how we let our feelings go unsaid, and the time we lose when intentions are misread. And ain't it sad how we misjudge so many signs of love, like Lester and Betty and the heel of the bread. Like Lester and Betty and the heel of the bread.
That's beautiful.
That was
Thank
nice.
You.
That's really beautiful. Nice.
How'd you like
yeah.
that?
Very nice.